And welcome to another episode of The Fifth Estate. My name is Jay Caruso. I'm here with my co-host, Neil Dewing. How are you?
Happy to be here, Jay, and happy to have all our listeners with us once again.
Once again. All right. And, you know, as we say always, you know, you like the show, go out there, subscribe on iTunes, leave us a rating, tell us how much you hate me, tell everybody how much you love Neil, vice versa, whatever. We kind of like that. We're going to talk presidential politics, and not so much the politics, but rather the media coverage of presidential campaigns. You know, how they are today, what they looked like, you know, in 92, 2000, the differences, and what better way to do that than to have a veteran reporter from the Washington Post, and also from she wrote for Time Magazine, and you'll see her sometimes on Fox News with Brett Baer. Karen Tumulty is here with us today.
It's great. Hi there. Hi, guys. Great to be here.
We thank you. Thank you for taking some time out of your schedule to talk with us. So we really appreciate it. You know, we always do.
Yes, we do.
So, Karen, let me start off right away by giving you a chance to kind of give your background on covering presidential campaigns. You know, what was your first one? You know, what's one of your favorites? Kind of just, you know, just give your background, some of the stuff that you've done, some of the crazier things that you've seen. We'd be happy to hear about all that.
Sure. Well, I got to Washington in the mid-80s for the Los Angeles Times. So I went to the conventions in 84, but I never really was out on the campaign trail until 88. And I covered primarily, oddly enough, the dying days of Al Gore's 88 campaign, and then Jesse Jackson most of that year, and Lloyd Benson. And then 92 and 96, I covered the campaigns a bit, but in both years I had babies. So that was, I ended up having to cut that one short. But then in 2000, I was the primary reporter on the Al Gore campaign for Time Magazine. And after that, I was their national political correspondent, which had me sort of all over the place in 04 and 08. And then I joined Time and then I joined the Washington Post in 2010, and I've sort of the same thing. I'm, you know, not generally assigned to one campaign. I kind of go from story to story, which has had me do things, you know, a lot of really varied things this cycle. From, you know, I just recently did a profile of Trump's campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. I went down to Mexico last year and sort of researched Columba Bush's family roots. You know, it's a fun job because I get to kind of roam around and, you know, take a look at the campaign from all different kinds of angles.
I've always found those kind of stories so interesting because, you know, you can follow the horse race, you know, the facts and figures and you know, who's polling well, but those pieces that flesh out the characters that are, you know, at play here, those are the ones that they are.
I mean, I, you know, do write plenty of horse race stories, but I must say the ones that I find the most satisfaction from and the ones that I feel like, you know, at the end of the year and at the end of the election cycle that are the most memorable are not the horse race stories. They really are the ones where, you know, especially where you as a reporter are out kind of on your own sort of trying to do something that breaks some ground as opposed to sitting on somebody's bus or somebody's plane.
What, since you started, like, you know, so you, the first one you kind of covered was the Gore campaign and then Jesse Jackson, but I would say probably, I guess 2000 might've been the first real big one. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it was hard to be much bigger than 2000, especially after election day.
Right.
Sure. So what? Like, do you have anything from 2000 that stands out? Is there anything that you remember? Something that, you know, trying to get some inside scoop here. I mean, you know, is there anything that happened behind the scenes? Anything that you can talk about that, you know, you kind of remember that stands out from that time?
Well, the weirdest thing that happened to me through the whole, I mean, obviously the biggest thing was being there on election night in Nashville and, you know, thinking we were going to have a winner and going to bed at 5 in the morning after all the weirdness that happened, and waking up the next morning and thinking, did I dream all that? But the sort of weirdest thing, I think, probably that happened to me individually in that campaign, and it really is, it's as much a media story as anything, was I was working on, in 1999, working on what was going to be a cover story, a profile of Al Gore. And there were only, the great thing, and there are fewer and fewer of these opportunities in covering campaigns now, but the great thing in the early phases of doing these is that, like, you know, I could get on Air Force Two, and there was only one other reporter on the plane with me, and that was Rick Burke of the New York Times. And so Gore comes back in the plane and sits down with us for 3.5 hours, just chit-chatting. And again, this almost never happens these days. But so as we are talking, he tells a story. He had just seen his college roommate, Tommy Lee Jones, the actor. Mm-hmm. And he was reminiscing about college, and he said, you know, the funny thing is, we knew Eric Segal, the author of Love Story, and, you know, Love Story was based on me and Tipper. And so then I said, what? And he said, oh, well, that's at least what Eric Segal has told people. So anyway, so I write my cover story. The part about Love Story is not even a whole sentence about 3/4 of the way through the cover story. And it's a subordinate clause saying this. And it sort of sits there for a few days, and other reporters read it, and they went, wait, you know, Love Story was based on Al and Tipper? So for a few days, Gore's office confirmed it. And then a few days after that, a New York Times reporter got to Eric Segal, the author of Love Story, and he said, well, no, it wasn't. But, you know, it turns out that, Al Gore it was an amalgam of people. And one of them, in fact, had been Tommy Lee Jones. But it blew up into this kind of Al Gore makes up the fact that Love Story is based on him, which wasn't, you know, precisely what happened. And in fact, the character was partly based on him. But it just turned into one of these gigantic, you know, media storms, and, you know, it sort of helped with the narrative of Al Gore doesn't tell the truth.
Well, and I remember this was the first election I was kind of politically aware. And so I remember just Al Gore claimed he invented the internet, that sort of thing. So I imagine it fed into that perception.
It did. And it was sort of weird for me for, you know, a couple of weeks to be sort of sitting there in the middle of, you know, this what would turned into just this media firestorm.
So, all right. So then, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, obviously 2000, I remember this image. This was like the first kind of like internet election. I remember a story being done about Al Gore. I still remember the photo of Al Gore's team. They were whiteboarding out what the website was going to look like when the first time when the internet had come into play into elections. At that time, there was still no social media. It was just really having a website. And kind of go into how it's changed over. I mean, things have changed so fast, just from 2000 even to just 2008. You know, 2008, Barack Obama was utilizing Twitter to get his message out.
Right.
And then, of course, then you go, Facebook, and it's just gotten bigger.
And the reporters, too. I mean, it was like the, you know, 2000, yes, the web existed, but it was kind of a one-way conversation. Yeah, I mean, and Drudge was out there, but the web was there for you to go to their website and get information. And so I was a Newsweekly reporter and would occasionally write things for our website, but really my job was writing for a magazine. And by 2008, and I spent most of my time in 2008, I spent some time on the McCain campaign, but mostly on the Obama campaign. And by 2008, I had a blog, I was tweeting, I was writing for, you know, I was writing for the website, and on top of all of that, I was writing for the magazine. So in those kind of 8 years, just everything had changed. And I think it just not only changes it changes the pace of the coverage. I think in many ways it changes the quality of the coverage, and it also changes the kind of relationship that you can have as a reporter with the candidate.
You say it changes the quality. You think not for the better?
Well, I think there's like good sides and bad sides to it. I think that with the immediacy of it, you know, a candidate is not going to just come back in the plane and just sort of shoot the breeze with a couple of reporters for 3.5 hours,
right,
the way they used to then. And the other thing is it gives them a capability to package themselves. And, you know, Obama, I think, was the first guy to really get this, which gives them a way of just completely going around the, you know, the old-fashioned media filter.
I remember that there were some complaints that he would almost shut out journalists. They would only be able to get what the campaign approved from the campaign. They wouldn't get the unrestricted access of the sort that you explained earlier with Al Gore.
And it was certainly true. I mean, it was certainly true once he got to the White House, especially. I mean, in the 08 campaign, you could still, like, occasionally get him on the phone.
Oh, okay.
But there was just not the kind of intensity of the access that you would get, you know, before these guys felt like they were constantly on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And is that change that you think that the candidates have always become more guarded?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they have also become, you know, the packagers, and more so than even in the past, the packagers of their own messages. You know, they not only pick the message, they pick the medium.
That's interesting. Well, what do you think about, okay, so let's talk a little bit about Donald Trump and his campaign. I think it's fair to say if we went back to July of 2015, I think if we had asked anybody for their opinion, including you, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe you were like back then, you were like, I think he can do this. But I think most.
Oh, heck no.
Okay. So, I mean, what you've seen so far, I don't know how much of the Trump campaign you've covered, but have you spoken with people? What's the kind of sense that you get that despite all of the negatives that surrounds him and all the things that he's done, yet he still has this contingent of people that are just kind of like going crazy about him? Have you talked to anybody? Is there any kind of insight you can give us on that?
In terms of his supporters, or
yeah, I mean,
I can tell you that. You know, I have covered, you don't cover his campaign like a campaign. I mean, he's extraordinarily accessible. I talked to him last Tuesday night, you know, as the returns were coming in from Indiana. When I was doing my profile with Corey Lewandowski, I went down to Mar-a-Lago and, you know, spent 4 hours. And, you know, Trump was just sort of wandering around in his Make America Great Again hat. I mean, he's just incredibly accessible. So I guess that undermines everything else I've been saying. But the other thing is, you know, people will say, how come he gets so much media coverage? How much he, you know, but we can measure now what it is people want to read, what they want to know about. You know, my editors know every story. They not only know how many people are clicking on it, they know where they're coming from, they know where they're going, they know how far into a story they're reading. And the thing that just comes screaming through about Donald Trump is that people just can't get enough of him. Whether it's people who love him or people who hate him, they just want to read everything they can about the guy. And he's really smart, I think, in understanding that and making himself available.
What about, let me ask you this, and this is something that's strange, and I'm wondering I want to hear about what Neil has to think about this. Donald Trump has been allowed to, and this is just kind of like I'm nitpicking here, but I'd still like to know what you think about it. Normally when a candidate is going to appear on a news show, I mean, either he's there in the studio or they have the person go to a remote and so they can have him on screen. Donald Trump, unlike any other candidate I have ever seen in any kind of race is allowed to call in on the telephone and speak, which I think puts the people who are doing the interview at a complete disadvantage. I think it's a lot easier to kind of like brush off a question or pretend you didn't hear something or do something if you're on the phone. Why do you think a lot of these newsrooms have allowed that?
And by the way, not all of them have.
Okay.
I think for instance, Fox News Sunday has not allowed him to do that.
Okay.
But I may be wrong on that, so don't.
Well, it's possible Fox News Sunday, but he has been on other shows on Fox News
exactly,
Channel, right?
Exactly. And it's, again, back to the, they let him dictate the terms because they know that he brings ratings. So, I mean, is it a good practice? No. Is it a healthy practice? Absolutely not. But, and I think, you know, there's been maybe a little bit of reconsideration about this. I noticed, by the way, that Hillary Clinton is now doing that too.
That's great. That's awesome. Oh, she should. She honestly should. If Trump can do it, then she should be able to do it. And I think you nailed it, Karen. I think it really is about Trump bringing viewers, bringing listeners, bringing eyeballs on these things. He drives engagement. He drives ratings, and that's why we've gotten so much Trump coverage. And that's why he's allowed to call in when other candidates would have to wake up at 5 in the morning and put on their makeup and get in front of a camera. I think that's really is it's a simple explanation and kind of goes into the idea that journalism is in many ways it's a calling, but I think in many more ways it's still very much a business.
It's also a business with a broken business model. Mm-hmm. It's a business that's under a lot of economic stress. So, you know, I think the networks are not going to turn down somebody who brings eyeballs.
Well, they can't. I mean, they really can't. I watch movies from, you know, like the 1980s or 1970s, and the reporters are talking about, well, I'll just expense this cross-country flight to California to cover this story. You know, I don't remember what movie. I'm thinking of Fletch or something like that with Chevy Chase, which I don't know. But he's like expensing Lakers games and stuff like that or helicopter rides. I don't think that happens anymore, Karen. Does that happen?
It's, things have loosened up a little at the Washington Post. Thank you, Jeff Bezos. But, we definitely are, you know, we economize a lot more than we used to. You know, a White House trip is incredibly expensive because you've got to pay for your share of the charter. So you're even seeing not only political campaign coverage, but, you know, government coverage. And I think the most unhealthy part of all of this is that so many local newspapers that used to be all over their members of Congress have also shut down their Washington bureaus. So what I think is the most pernicious part of all of this is that, you know, these like individual members of Congress, these obscure federal agencies, there aren't the bodies there to cover them anymore.
And what about, so, I mean, is that, do you think that hinders some of the coverage because how much do you think that reporters rely on the stories of other reporters in order to write their own stories? I mean, I always have the image in my head, and it's probably a lot romanticized with all the president's men when Woodward and Bernstein are sitting there going through the book request slips, you know, and they're going through this whole thing and trying to find, you know, this little piece of information. But how, do you think at all, and just asking, has the journalistic community grown a little, is it because of those financial restrictions, or do you think it's because they're a little lazier, want to get the story out there faster, that they're not kind of doing the research that a lot of them should be doing? Do you see that kind of thing in
I think it's all of that. But, you know, also at the same time, as a result, there's a lot of really crappy journalism around, but there's also, I would argue, more good journalism around too than there's ever been before. It's you know, technology giveth and technology taketh. So, And there are opportunities, too, for outlets that are not the New York Times and the Washington Post to reach a gigantic readership. You know, you don't have to control a printing press and a bunch of barrels of ink anymore to get to people.
Right. I mean, and you know, it, that's obvious. I mean, you know, Neil and I are doing this right now because we start, you know, because we started a blog three years ago that kind of it expanded from there. So
and nobody has been able to stop us.
Unstoppable force.
Gets out. And the, you know, one of the problems is, though, that, you know, there is a lot of stuff that isn't so good, but there's also a lot of appetite for stuff that isn't so good.
Right. And I guess that a lot of that feeds into the you know, how much of what you read, especially from some very popular websites that, you know, run with stuff. And, you know, if there's millions of people looking at it, how quickly it spreads around. We were kind of discussing this last week with Dana Perino. It's like Twitter almost instead of news coverage driving what people see on Twitter, it's almost the reverse, that Twitter can sometimes drive what people see on the news.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And I don't know what the answer to all of this is, but it's just that the echo chamber is so loud that, you know, it is harder and harder for people to sort of pull back and, you know, look inside their own brains and say, does this make sense? Is this, you know, the narrative is, it just feels like the narrative catches on faster than it used to. And as a result, that's why we've had so many comeuppances this year, because people will sort of buy into, you know, the whole Trump phenomenon. It's not only the media, but, you know, written into political science, the party decides. I don't know how many political scientists have done their treatises on how the party always gets its way. Well, except when it doesn't. And I think, you know, we all sort of buy into the narrative, but also we buy into what we've seen happen over and over and over again in the past. And this really has been a year where, you know, you can get yourself in trouble by doing that.
I think part of it, too, is whereas before, journalists, they have always decided what is newsworthy and what's going to be in the news to an extent. Sometimes events, you know, are too big to ignore or something like that, but they decide what's going to be discussed and what's going to be worthy of being in the newspaper or being on the evening news. But now, with social media and various other forms of communication, the consumer of the news can see how that news is being made. And I think some people don't really like the idea of media gatekeepers, which to a dramatic extent no longer exist. Again, the example of blogs and social media and Jay Caruso and Neil Doing having a show is the refutation of the idea of media gatekeepers. Somebody should have stopped Jay and I from doing this, but nobody did.
And there's a lot about that's really healthy. What is unhealthy, though, is when viewers and readers and listeners then sort themselves only into outlets that are telling them things that they already agree with, and then that therefore
yes.
sort of reinforce their not only existing opinions, but their, you know, existing views of the facts that aren't necessarily accurate, which is, you know, why we've seen so many, you know, that's why so many people in this country think the president's a Muslim and that he was born in Africa.
Right, and it's
easier than ever to do that now. You can only read news from certain sources that confirm your pre-existing notions of how the world operates. And you see this in I think, journalism of every subject, from politics to sports to science journalism. You know, we have debates in this country about we look at the same facts and figures and people interpret them differently, and based on your philosophy of life, that's who you decide has given you the correct or true version of the news.
And it's, you know, what I think was a really kind of seminal moment in all of that was in the 2004 campaign, because it also changes the way politicians now react to things. Because in 2004, when the Swiss Boat Veterans for Truth were formed and put out their, you know, now infamous TV ads about John Kerry, suggesting, you know, he had completely lied about his record in Vietnam, Kerry's reaction was to look at this in a very traditional way. Well, this is just a very small ad buy from a very small fringe group, and I'm just not going to respond to it. It is beneath my responding to. And I'm going to sit here and I'll let the New York Times look into the facts and decide what the real truth was. And what he didn't calculate was, first of all, that ad would take on a life of its own, not because of the amount of money that was put into the ad buy, but because it got picked up on the internet, it got picked up on cable TV, it was suddenly the topic of the day. But also, by the time the New York Times did, in fact, get around to doing their big, you know, investigation of is there any truth to all this? And yes, it started on the front page, and it was a double truck inside, and it basically said, you know, that these, you know, the claims being made by the Swiss Boat Veterans for Truth were not true. By the time that happened, so much damage had already been done, and people had already sort of decided what side of this they were on. And, you know, it was just a massive mistake on Kerry's part not to think that it was beneath his dignity to respond to this and just to rely on kind of the old media filters for doing that. So that is why I think that is really, since then, you really have seen rapid response on the part of the campaigns develop into, you know, one of the key elements of their operations.
Well, let me ask you about that, the rapid response, because that becomes, I've seen now, and we're not talking about, you know, necessarily responses to conservative outlets or to liberal outlets, but even just like responses to mainstream outlets, like, you know, like the Washington Post or Los Angeles Times, an article will be written, somebody will write something, and then there's somebody that will pick it apart, you know, so that if you have left out or you've managed to miss one tiny little thing, it's like they call the entire article into question. And the credibility of the writer into question, because there's a little bit of a mistake. I mean, reporters are not infallible. You guys are going to make errors or make mistakes. And it used to be, okay, we're going to go back and we're going to correct this. But now all of a sudden it seems if you do, suddenly you're into that camp like Neil was talking about, where it's just like, well, that source can no longer be trusted.
Well, and also when you print the correction, the same people who were tearing you down will trumpet the correction. They will broadcast, oh, look at the correction. Yeah. Well, and if there's anything wrong with your correction, God help you. If you still didn't nail it in the correction, then they will tear you into even smaller pieces.
I'm sure, Karen, you can probably tell us stories about your mailbag alone.
Right. And again, all of this is healthy on many, many levels, but where it is not healthy is when a mistake, or even sometimes what's criticized is the sheer fact that you even decided to do a story on topic A or topic B, that is somehow seen as proof of your bias. And, you know, some days that I would really like to introduce my critics at Media Matters to my critics at Newsbusters, because
I was just going to ask you about that. It's like what you thought of the media critics, because you're probably one, I would think, and I've read your work, and it's really good, and I'm sitting here thinking she's probably one of those ones that probably gets it from both sides if there's something wrong. And Media Matters is to kind of discuss the difference between Media Matters and Newsbusters. Media Matters is much more meticulous. They'll go into every tiny little thing. Newsbusters will kind of, I think, hone in on one statement and say, you know, here's what's so bad about this, or why this is so biased, or anything like that. And do you think that shapes the way you cover news, or do you just sit there and say, you know what, I'm going to do what I've always been doing, and, you know, the critics be damned?
I think that what it does is it does make it gives you pause. That in the end, you've got to decide. If, you know, you've got to go with what you think is, you know, the right course on a story. And you know, often it means going to your editors and sitting down and discussing it and making sure that, you know, you all anticipate what the criticism is going to be and make sure that they're going to have your backs on this, you know, quite frankly.
And how important is that for you as a writer to know, or for anybody really to know, that their editors are going to be there to support them if something happens that way?
It's very important, and it's harder, and you know, things now move so fast. It's really harder and harder to you know, to make sure like everybody has signed off on something. I'm trying to think of a good example of this. Oh, this goes back to 2008, and John McCain put up a web ad that some sort of sinister looking images of Barack Obama and Frank Rains, who was then the head of Fannie Mae. And they're both African-American. And the whole thing was like, I took it to my editors and I said, what do you think about this? I mean, is this sort of like race baiting? And my editors looked at it and they said, yeah. So I wrote not even a story. I wrote a blog post about, you know, take a look at the images in this ad. And, you know, when people play the race card, they don't do it directly. And, you know, this ad is troublesome. Well, they did take the ad down, but they also came after me really big time and accused me of, in their words, hysterical liberal bias. But and this was one where I was glad that, you know, before I'd written the blog post, I had made sure that every editor, you know, at Time Magazine, not only my Washington bureau chief, but the national editor had both seen the ad, had both kind of seen what I saw in the ad. So I knew that, you know, when the complaints started coming in, that, you know, this was a kind of an institutional decision, even though my name had been on the blog post.
See, Karen, I always took the opposite approach with my writing. And I would say the thing that I wanted to say, and then the complaints would start to roll in, and I would talk to my editors, and they'd be like, Neil, you know, could you maybe just run something by us before you attach it to our name? That would be awesome.
I always had the pleasure of asking Neil to write about stuff that I knew was going to get a visceral response.
Yeah, Jay would set me up. That was a further wrinkle here in this whole editor-writer relationship, is when your editor sets you up because he knows you can't resist. So
yeah, so beware of that, Karen. Next time, if you ever get to a point where they're saying, "Hey, why don't you write about this?" when it all comes like fire on you, then you'll know that they're kind of sitting there snickering about it.
But you know, Karen, I want to circle back. We were talking about, you know, getting criticized from Media Matters and getting criticized by newsbusters, and you know, that made me kind of think about objectivity in journalism. And that is the standard, but I think we know from history and even as recently as the 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, objectivity was not really the goal for journalism. Periodicals, journals, newspapers were funded by moneyed people or by political organizations, and they had an express slant. And I'm wondering, how do you see objectivity in journalism? Do you see the emphasis on objectivity today? Do you think objectivity in journalism is going to remain something that that major media pursues?
There are just so many different ways to sort of cut at that. I think that because the Washington Post, for instance, is no longer what lands on your front sidewalk. The Washington Post is this, you know, gigantic, you know, big ball of content. Mm-hmm. And we do have a lot more writers at the paper who write from a point of view than we have people like me who are, you know, not supposed to write from a point of view. But that, by the way, I've never been somebody who subscribes to the idea that fair and balanced are the same thing. You know, sometimes it is, you can objectively decide that one set of social programs is going to work or not work, or that, you know, one set of claims that a candidate is making is true or not true.
Right.
But anyway, but back to my point, it's like there are now so many voices, and again, some who are not on the editorial page necessarily, but they, you know, people who write on our website from a, you know, a liberal or a conservative bent. And I think that often it's probably hard for our readers to figure out, you know, where's the, you know, and we don't have these kind of clear label analysis on things, or, you know, this is our liberal perspective on this. And I do wonder at what point people get confused, you know, when they are reading in the Post, and, you know, things aren't, not everything carries a label, you know.
It's true.
I mean,
but
like Dana Milbank is a good example. I mean, Dana writes, I think, a lot of things from, you know, a liberal viewpoint, but he's on page two of the paper, you know. So it's, and by the way, I'm a huge, huge fan of his, and I like his edge and I like his attitude, but, he's not there to sort of be the daily political reporter.
Mm-hmm. But I think when you see something in print, especially, it does have a certain authority. You just, I know I assign it just mentally, and I know it's a completely irrational thing to do, but you see it in print, it's committed to the page. It just seems more authoritative, and it seems that if it is being published, well, that must be the editorial position of the publisher, but that's not necessarily the case. It could be presenting different viewpoints, as you say, having more voices in the mix rather than and making a conscious effort to do that.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I think 10 years from now, I think the print product is going to be a very expensive kind of boutique product.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it read by really old people, and everything else is going to be online.
I think that's
or on
such a
whatever
shame.
It is. By who knows? Maybe we will have, you know, chips implanted in our brains, and it'll
be a retina display that just flashes up. I'll tell you. I think the transition to digital is such a shame, because I don't know about you, but for me, when I read something on paper, it sticks better than when I read it on a computer screen. I might be a weirdo, but it just doesn't seem. I don't absorb it as well when I'm reading it off of a tablet or off of my phone or off of a computer screen as I do when I unfold the paper. I have a cup of coffee and I'm sitting here sipping it, and you know, if somebody comes to interrupt me while I'm reading, I can, you know, dramatically, you know, flip down the paper and glare at them. There's a whole lot of charm to the newspaper. So I would hate for it to become something only hipsters read.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Karen. Go ahead.
But for me, increasingly, though, what I've seen in the newspaper, for instance, a lot of the content for the Sunday newspaper is online on Thursday. So I will pick up my newspaper, whether it's Us or the New York Times or whatever, or I will have read it at 5 o'clock the day before online. So, you know, increasingly I find myself with the print product kind of flipping it through it and thinking, I already read that, you know.
I've had that too. And it is. It's I think for some people maybe who aren't as plugged in, and who aren't as hungry for the, you know, for the updates as I am. I always want to know what's happening every single day, you know, multiple times during the day. I check in. I'm like, okay, what's going on? What's the latest? But not everybody does that. And I don't think people's news consumption was like that up until very recently. It was wait for the evening news, 6 o'clock or 11 o'clock, whichever. Watch that, get the morning paper, and see what happened. You know what people think about it overnight.
Yeah, and my kids get absolutely, my kids who were raised by two journalists get none of their news on, on paper.
None of them. So that's interesting. I just had started getting the Wall Street Journal delivered about a month and a half ago. And like Neil was saying, I seem to get more out of reading the written word. And I think it's largely because it's harder to get distracted. When you're sitting there reading a story in the paper, you're pretty much, you have the paper, you have the story, and that's really all you can do. Whereas you're reading something on your phone or a tablet. Let me see what's going on Twitter. Let me check Facebook real quick. Let me do this real fast. So it's
Or you
very
get
easy to
sucked
get
into like
distracted.
a Wikipedia black hole where you like, what does this mean? And you go look it up on Wikipedia, and then like, oh, that's an interesting link. D-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-d-
You keep going. Next thing you know, you've been reading a story on tax reform, and now you're looking at, you know, the cast of Grease.
Yeah, somehow or you're reading about the Peninsular War or something like that. How did we get here? How did I start reviewing military fashion of the 1820s? I don't know.
Right. Well, I also I've got a weakness for those galleries of, you know, 15 child stars. What are they doing now?
There's a reason people make those, because people click on them.
It is one of those things. You see it down there and you're like, I'm not clicking on those. And then there's always the one that says, okay, this one I'll check out. And it's perfect because they get those views, because it's like, you know, there's 15 or 20 of them and you got to page through four times just to get to the second one. So
worst celebrity plastic surgery. You know?
It's what the people want.
All right. So let me ask you about what was, if you could relay a story, I'd love to hear a story about any presidential candidate. Is there any kind of like something that really stands out, something that said, you know, that not that you separated yourself as a reporter and said, this is really great. You know, this is just great to be a part of, you know, in terms of just being an American, being living in the country and being a part of a campaign, like covering a campaign, but not so much as a reporter where you just sat there and said, this is really great. I mean, it's great to be here and be able to be a part of this. Is there anything that stands out like that?
You know, it was just hard not to feel that, you know, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, being there in Grant Park on election night of 2008, you know, just to realize that the country had elected an African-American president for the first time. It was extraordinary. But what I really like is, you know, the early parts when you can get, the best parts about Iowa and New Hampshire are just really less what you see of the candidates and more what you see of the people and how really diverse the country is. And, you know, why it is so as strong as it is. You have to feel blessed that you're, you know, seeing these sometimes little slivers of history and sometimes big moments of history, but either way.
Interesting. Okay. Well,
I think that's a fantastic point, because I honestly sometimes imagine what it must be like to go to all 50 states and campaign, or as many states as you need to win the Electoral College, and see all these people who, despite being American, each state is very different. Each region of the country is very different. You know, it's little differences, like whether you call it soda or pop or Coke, right on down to the very real pressing concerns of people who live in the Rust Belt or people who suffer from poverty in the Deep South and that sort of thing. We just are a very different and diverse country, and I have trouble conceiving of it. Just I know my little sliver of it on the eastern seaboard here, And it's difficult for me to imagine going to like the Iowa State Fair and watching people eat deep fried butter off of a stick or something like that and enjoying it. I just don't get it. But that's people's lives.
Well, and I'm sort of grateful that, you know, I'm not originally from one of the coasts, because, you know, I can go home and talk to my family in Texas and just get a completely different reality than, you know, than what I hear in Washington.
It is. It's very different. People talk about the bubble, and it is good to get out of the bubble. You know, thankfully, I'm not cosseted up in D.C. or anything like that. I'm out in real America, as they say.
As they say, yeah, it is kind of interesting the perspective that you see even from outside. I mean, you know, and there's people that I know from that from the DC area, and they I don't know what it is. If you're there long enough, there seems to be like a haze that kind of goes over, you know, things, the way the perspective of people, the way they see things, because they're always kind of thinking about it in that Washington DC mindset. Whereas if, you know, once you leave that, you're like, oh, nobody's even talking about this at my house.
And you know, it's I a couple of years ago, and it's a story that I was ended up being really proud of. I just the paper decided that we were going to sort of pick a state with some quirky politics that were really changing fast and just figure it out. And so they sent me to West Virginia, and in fact, they sent me back to West Virginia 6 times
Oh,
to,
wow.
you know, just try and well. Because it was a state that had been so democratic for so long, and it was its politics were changing so fast. But so I was in this tiny, tiny little depressed town called Pineville, and talking to the county clerk, and I had noticed that there was a Ten Commandments monument out in front of the courthouse. And so I said, "Has that been there a long time?" And he got really silent, and he said, "It went up last week."
Oh, wow.
And so I, and ultimately it became very controversial because the ACLU found out about it. And, but anyway, so I went back to that little town a couple of more times. And, you know, people, they don't automatically open up to somebody who says, "Hi, I'm here from the Washington Post. Let's talk about your politics." But finally, you know, I caught a bunch of people who were at a church picnic and asked them, you know, "So why are you guys so wedded to this Ten Commandments monument?" And they started talking about so many things that were changing around them so fast. You know, all the coal industry jobs were going. OxyContin was a huge problem. Their kids were growing up hopeless. Their values were being laughed at by the rest of the country. They just felt like everything about their lives was out of control. And they said, you know, there's so little we can control, but there's on this one corner of our little town, we can control and we can state our own values. And for the first time, it just really made sense to me in a way that went so far beyond the kind of left-right arguments. It was really an expression of what was going on in their lives. And, you know, it's real easy for people to, you know, sort of on the coast to sort of write people off as narrow-minded or backwards. You know, these people were dealing with a lot of really big,
Yes.
scary changes and a real feeling of helplessness.
And they
And you
still
just don't
are.
get that. Yes, and you just don't get that in Washington. And I think that's why, you know, when Hillary Clinton got into so much trouble in West Virginia a couple of weeks ago by saying, you know, "We're going to be putting a lot of miners out of jobs." You know,
Right.
it's only if you are in those places and in them long enough and talk to people kind of on a deep enough level, do you understand that this is not about bigotry and it's not about backwardness. It's about, you know, it's about what you really see going on in your life.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. And you know, I think it's funny too, because I think her comment, I'll probably get in trouble for this, but I think her comment was probably taken a little bit out of context when she talked about that. But I also think that, you know, that's part of how the media covers this is that it there are so many times when, you know, a single statement is reported upon. You know, I always remember from 2012 when Mitt Romney said, I'm not concerned about the poor. And he was talking about it in the context of that there's programs that can help them and that, you know, this is what we're trying to do. But that one statement stood out. And it's these little statements that can really do damage to a campaign. Whereas I think, and I don't know, maybe you agree with me or not, if you went back to say like in the 1980s or 1992 or something like that, then maybe it wouldn't have been such a big thing because probably chances are if it was a local campaign stop or a local news team doing the coverage, that people might not even have known they said it.
Yeah, although don't forget, Mitt Romney's father was knocked out at the 1968 presidential race because of one line where he said he'd been brainwashed in Vietnam.
That's right.
So, it's possible, but there is this kind of, there is sort of an amplifier effect to this stuff now. And interestingly enough, except for, you know, Donald Trump has figured out that he's just not going to, he's not going to play that game, you know? He just sort of blows right through. He never says he's sorry for anything he said.
That's true.
He, you know, it doesn't feel the need to sort of pretend that things were not consistent, are consistent. He just has decided, you know, just when we think there's one set of rules, a figure like Donald Trump comes along and proves that they don't exist.
Which is very depressing.
Neil, don't get her in trouble here.
No. But I agree. It's been quite an experience watching Donald Trump just sort of break every rule that we'd sort of, and they were unspoken rules, I would say, just etiquette and the way the game is played. And I think, if I'm being honest, I think it has a lot to do with what you mentioned about those people in West Virginia, Karen, a lot of feeling of being out of control. And there's been such an effort on the part of both conservative media and I think mainstream media to try to understand what the heck is happening with this Trump thing. But I think you really, the human element, you have to look at that. You have to look at people's lives and where they are. And
people, his supporters like it that he doesn't have a filter.
They love
it. You know, you go and you talk to them, and I have talked to a lot of them. And the first thing when you ask them, you know, what's his appeal? The first thing that comes out of their mouth almost, you know, unanimously is always, he says what he thinks. And then you say, well, what about this horrible thing he just said about women or, you know, POWs or whatever, and then they'll say, oh, he didn't mean that. And the people with Donald Trump are somehow able to sort of simultaneously hold these two ideas in their head about him, that he says what he thinks, but then when he says something that's offensive, he didn't mean it. and it's I've never seen anything like that before either, but no,
well, yeah, because I don't think we've ever seen a candidate who talks like that to have such a large profile. I mean, you may have had smaller candidates who didn't really, you know, make. I mean, the closest you can come to that probably is Ross Perot, who never really said anything offensive. He just said stuff that people weren't talking about. I don't think anybody ever mentioned. I don't think anybody ever talked about the deficit prior to 1992. So I mean, it was just like that. But I mean, this is something on a whole new level. So you got your work cut out for you in the general. That's for sure.
It's so much fun. I'm telling you, if you can't have fun this election, you shouldn't be a political writer.
I'm sitting there saying it's like if you're in if there's like if you have to like draw straws in the newsroom to see who you're going to cover, Hillary or Donald Trump throughout the campaign, it's probably going to be a fight because if I'm a reporter, I want to be with the Trump people. I want to follow them around. I mean, you know, Hillary is, of course, you know, and this is my opinion, is so scripted that everything is just, you know, is kind of like fed to her and say, this is what you have to say, this is what you have to do. Whereas, yeah, I mean, let's face it, Trump is just going to say whatever he means. And, you know, then, of course, people are going to say, well, he didn't mean that. But like
but,
you said,
but
it's an
Jay,
interesting dynamic.
Jay, you're forgetting Bill Clinton is going to Puerto Rico, which sounds pretty nice this time of year.
That is
the Virgin
true.
Islands, if you can hop on that flight, that's not so
Yeah, I
bad.
can't. There's no playing with him. You can't keep up with him.
All right, well, that's good. We're out of time, and Karen, thank you so much for joining. This was
Oh,
great.
you're welcome. It was great talking to you guys.
It was fantastic. We do have one more piece of business, though, Karen. One more piece.
Oh, what's that?
Hold on. If you hear in the background.
We have this ongoing, never-ending debate, Jay and I, and it's near and dear to both our hearts. And we ask of all our guests, who is better, Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin? And I want you to be completely open and honest with us about this.
That's not even a contest.
Okay. What is it?
Well, Frank Sinatra.
Yes! Neil, you are really on a bad streak here, my friend. I mean, we have five episodes now, Karen, and we're 4-1, Sinatra.
It
hurts. Well, of course.
I'm enjoying this.
It's tough. It's really tough, but I'm gonna muddle through somehow. And I appreciate your honesty, Karen. Your brutal, brutal honesty.
All right, so Karen Tumulty, you can read her at the Washington Post, and they can follow you K Tumulty on Twitter, right?
That's right.
Okay, and are you still going on Fox News? Are you still appearing with Bret Baier and those guys? Are you?
Yeah. Well, I did it last week.
Okay.
I'm on Greta's show sometimes too.
Okay, terrific, terrific. Well, thank you again so much for being here. Hey, you'll come back, right? Especially during the general campaign
Oh.
to talk about it, will you?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
Happy to do it.
we'd love to check back in with you as this thing progresses.
Great. Okie
All right. Well, appreciate you very much. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Neil, thank you, sir.
Happy to do it.
You're being a good sport, even though Frank Sinatra is kicking Dean's butt.
I'm used to disappointment.
It's something that comes with the territory, especially in politics. You're always going to be used to that. Okay. So thank you everyone for listening. Again, go out to iTunes. We love when you subscribe. Subscriptions are great, and tell your friends about it as well. So that's going to do it. And we will see you next time here on the Fifth Estate. Your love. Give me wings nel blu dipinto de blu venite di stare lassù nel blu dipinto di blu.